from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
مغرور يا هوى يا هوى. This last week was, I would say, DC politics at its worst. Watching what played out in Congress regarding this funding and the conversation that surrounded it over the last several days is an example of the ways in which leadership, Democratic leadership, and the GOP in particular, are willing to just play games with people's lives and score political points in whatever way they can.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. On Thursday of this past week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that would give Israel an additional $1 billion in military aid for its missile defense system known as the Iron Dome. Progressives in the House had earlier managed to strip the bill as an attachment to a must-pass government funding bill known as a continuing resolution. In response, Democratic Majority Leader Steny Hoyer put the legislation on the floor as a standalone bill without going through the normal committee process or what is called regular order. I spoke to Beth Miller, Senior Government Affairs Manager at JVP Action, about the political maneuvering that brought the bill to the floor and to its ultimate passage. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast.
Hi, Dave. Thank you so much for having me on.
Before we jump into talking about the Iron Dome bill, tell us about JVP Action and the work that you do there.
Absolutely. So JVP Action is the political and advocacy arm of Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP. JVP has been around for 25 years and is a national grassroots movement organization of Jews and allies that are working toward justice in Palestine. We have 70 chapters across the country. We have a student network, a health advisory council, a rabbinic council. We are a vast and rapidly growing movement of folks nationally, all of whom believe that it is our role as American Jews and allies to influence U.S. policy to actually work for justice and equality for all Palestinians and Israelis. JVP Action was launched in 2019, so we are the 501c4, and JVP Action focuses specifically on congressional advocacy work and on electoral organizing, with the goal of, again, a more just U.S. foreign policy that actually centers human rights and equality and justice. So my role with JVP Action is that I head up all our congressional advocacy work, which we do a lot of and have been doing for years, as well as our newer electoral organizing. Last cycle, the 2020 election cycle, was our first time around the block actually endorsing candidates. And I think, you know, JVP Action is doing tons of really exciting work, but I will say that one of the things that feels most exciting about JVP Action is that we exist. There was a time where I think no one working in the Palestinian rights movement thought it made much sense for there to be a 501c4 for groups that are anti-Zionist, pro-BDS organizations. But JVP Action exists because we knew that the political moment was right for it, and that we actually were in a turning point moment where we could really be electing, supporting, and advocating to Palestinian rights advocates in power, in government.
Let's talk about the Iron Dome. First, what is it, and how much money has the United States given Israel to support it?
So the Iron Dome is essentially a weapon system that intercepts rockets. It's a missile interceptor system. And the goal of the Iron Dome is to prevent any rockets sent from Gaza from landing in Israel. That is essentially what the Iron Dome is. The U.S. has been funding the Iron Dome for at least a decade, it sent about $1.7 billion in funding to the Iron Dome since 2011. We actually send, every year, the U.S. sends $3.8 billion in military funding to the Israeli government. That is part of this 10-year Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, that was reached during the Obama administration. that agreed to $38 billion. And that breaks down to $3.8 billion every year. Within that $3.8 billion, there is specifically $500 million that goes towards supporting the Iron Dome. And so every year that gets really marked up and passed quite easily. There's rarely any objections to that $500 million for the Iron Dome. But over the course of 10 years, we have put about $1.7 billion toward the Iron Dome specifically as part of that huge, huge amount of money that we send to the Israeli military altogether.
This bill started out as an attachment on a short-term government spending bill, but ultimately came to the floor as a standalone piece of legislation. Can you explain the political maneuvering that brought us to the dramatic conclusion that we saw on Thursday?
This last week was, I would say, DC politics at its worst. Watching what played out in Congress regarding this funding and the conversation that surrounded it over the last several days is an example of just the ways in which leadership, Democratic leadership, and the GOP in particular, are willing to just play games with people's lives and score political points in whatever way they can. So as you mentioned, this all started, I'll actually go a little bit back to before what you kind of mentioned. So this first started back in June when, following Israel's military assault on the Gaza Strip in May, which killed over 200 Palestinians, including 66 children. And, you know, the UN Human Rights Council is now opening an investigation into possible war crimes by the Israeli military in May during that assault. Following that assault, the Israeli government said that they were going to be requesting an additional $1 billion from the U.S. government to, quote, replenish the Iron Dome. We first heard about this from Senator Lindsey Graham when he visited Israel in June. He is actually the one who broke the news. He announced on his trip that the Israeli government would be requesting this money and that the United States would, of course, fund it and send them this money. Over the course of months, we were all trying to track exactly where that official request lived, right? Where was it in Congress? Where did the request actually exist? And the Biden administration indicated that they would be supportive of sending an additional $1 billion. It was very clear that the administration was ready to do this. And the Israeli government did officially make the request over the summer. Earlier this week, Democratic Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, who is from Maryland, decided that it would be a very quick and easy thing to just throw this request for $1 billion onto what's known as the continuing resolution. Essentially, it's a must-pass bill, right? It's a keep-the-lights-on bill. This bill had to pass in order to avoid a government shutdown over the next couple months. At the very last minute, the night before this bill was set to be voted on the House floor, Hoyer threw this request into that bill. So he was basically saying, as part of all these other things that are included in this bill, let's just throw in this $1 billion request so that we can get Congress to authorize it. He threw it in because he thought that this would be the easiest thing in the world. Because Steny Hoyer represents the old guard of the Democratic Party, right? He comes out of a time in politics when no one blinked twice at giving Israel, the Israeli government, anything it wanted. That's the political reality that Steny Hoyer lives in. We do not live in that political reality anymore. We live in a time where the progressive wing of the Democratic Party understands that Palestinian rights have to be a core part of the broader progressive agenda. And so what I would imagine is, to Steny Hoyer's shock and horror and dismay, when he did that, progressives in Congress fought back. And they basically said, no, we will not allow you to sneak this $1 billion in military spending to the Israeli government into this bill at the last minute. Under no circumstances will we do this. And they used their pressure, they used their power, and they basically forced them to take the language out. So the CR passed and nobody had to vote on this $1 billion as part of it. I think it's important to note, especially given how horrible the vote that ended up happening on Thursday was, I do want to just take a moment to make clear what played out there in this moment where progressives did fight back is an important victory for the movement. It shows that the organizing that the Palestinian rights movement has been doing for years and years and years really has had ramifications in Congress. And we have made an impact to the point where progressives in Congress want to fight back against things like this in ways that really do use up their political capital, right? To do this took guts and power to kind of push back against this and strip the language from the continuing resolution bill. So it is important that that happened. Having said that, after it happened, Democratic leadership, Hoyer, realized they had made a terrible mistake, right? He had made a miscalculation and now he looked weak. He had been kind of beaten down by the progressives and forced to remove that language. And I imagine he was very worried that now the Democratic Party looked, quote unquote, bad on Israel, right? Predictably, when the news story broke that progressives had gotten this language stripped, Republicans had a field day, right? If you look on Twitter from what Republicans were saying after that happened, they were just going wild. It was, they were rushing to publicly say that this meant that the Democratic Party was anti-Semitic, that this meant that the Democrats, hated Israelis and wouldn't even fund defensive spending, and the lies ran rampant. And what's worse is that there were Democrats in Congress saying similar things, right? You had hawkish Democrats who were also saying that this was unacceptable. And so leadership, needing to rectify this miscalculation that they had made, wanted to grandstand. And so originally the discussion was going to be, we would take the language out of the continuing resolution and move it to a defense spending bill, put it as part of a broader, a later defense spending bill. Instead, Hoyer forced there to be what's known as a standalone vote, a standalone bill vote. So on Thursday, they suspended the rules to have a vote that was literally just about this $1 billion funding to the Israeli government. I want to pause here to make something very clear. There has been so much information going on about this $1 billion and about the Iron Dome and about our funding for the military. It is critical that everyone understand we already fund the Iron Dome. It's done. We fund it. We spend it. This was not about defunding or refusing to replenish the Iron Dome. This was about an additional $1 billion being added on top of what we already send. What's more, we do fund the Iron Dome, but there is a very important argument to be made about whether or not we should, right? All of this, every single dollar that we send to the Israeli military is still money that we are giving to an apartheid regime. So there is a very important question that Congress should be asking, which is, what does it mean for it to be, quote unquote, purely defensive when the military that we are giving it to is the aggressor, is the occupier, is the apartheid regime in this scenario? All of that to say, we were now in a position on Thursday where there were lies and misinformation running rampant, right? And the language being pushed out by anti-Palestinian organizations, by Democratic leadership, by the GOP, was that we had to fund this because otherwise we were abandoning Israel and, we didn't care about Israeli life. That was the message. In the end, when there was the final vote on Thursday, predictably, the bill passed with flying colors. The final vote was 420-9. There were nine no votes. Eight of those were brave progressives who stood up and said no to this bill. And then there were two present votes. So overall, 11 people refused to vote yes, and nine people actually voted no. Yep. This was a really unfortunate, sad moment, I think, for the Palestinian rights movement.
Do you think that Hoyer's initial move to just put the funding on the CR was an example of hubris and him being out of touch. But then when he decided to put it back as a standalone bill instead of attaching it to some other thing, was that an example of him trying to like land a blow at the progressives, like punch them for what they had done to strip? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really important question. I mean, we can all speculate. And I think that that was part of it personally. Yes. I think that it was a couple things. I think one, it was him trying to show that the Democratic Party will have unwavering support for the Israeli apartheid regime. And I think too, yeah, I think that he was trying to screw over the progressive left wing of his party. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, if we look at what's happening now, a lot of progressives were divided and split on this vote. So I do think that that was part of his calculation.
So let's get into this a little bit more about what's going on inside the Democratic Party. And you've touched on a number of things already. But during debate on the House floor, Rashida Tlaib said, quote, "The Israeli government is an apartheid regime," and sparked immediate condemnation from Republicans and Democrats. Most notably, I think, Ted Deutch, a Democrat from Florida. Can you give us some insight into, some more in-depth insight into the fight that's going on inside the Democratic Party over the United States relationship with Israel, and whether pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian voices are kind of organizing themselves or reorganizing themselves to counter what they must now be feeling is a more organized push from the progressives?
Watching Rashida Tlaib's speech on the House floor and then seeing the response from her colleagues was honestly one of the most heartbreaking moments.
It was shocking.
It was genuinely shocking. She got up and was the sole member of Congress, the only member of Congress who got up and actually spoke the truth about what was going on. She was the only person who got up and said, what's happening right now is we are rushing through $1 billion to fund an apartheid regime that is currently being investigated for war crimes. That's what's happening. And she's the only one who got up and said, we have to value everyone's life equally, right? We can't just value Israeli life. We have to value all life, and everyone deserves to live in safety. And that's not what Congress is saying right now. And after that, like you said, she got attacked and predictably smeared with false accusations that she was somehow anti-Semitic because she didn't want to send $1 billion to create a slush fund that an apartheid regime could pull from through 2024. And, you know, I think what we saw was the deep-seated, vicious anti-Palestinian racism that exists in Congress on just full open display. That's what we saw. Because not only did members like Ted Deutch attack her, but no one defended her, right? Not even the most basic, not even one of her colleagues got up and said, even if they were voting yes, no one even got up and said something like, these attacks on Representative Tlaib are unacceptable, and we won't allow for these kinds of attacks on her. No one even did that. And it is honestly so shocking and so horrifying to me. And it's hard to imagine how she must have felt, right? Being the sole voice in Congress who was speaking truth, and also being the only Palestinian in Congress, and having it fall to her to be the one person to say those things and to then be attacked and not defended is really a dark, sad day. And so that's what we saw play out. I think that, you know, what this speaks to on the broader scale is the conversation around this vote, the misinformation around it was that this was somehow the idea that this was somehow a vote to protect Jews and keep Jews safe, right? That was the messaging around it. That's not what this vote was about. This vote was about sending an extra $1 billion to inflate the military budget of Israel so that Israel could then use that money to buy more weapons from the US that they would then use to attack Palestinians more and to carry out the occupation and to fund apartheid and to fund ethnic cleansing. That's what is happening. And that's what this vote was really about. And so what we saw was that this isn't about keeping Jews safe. It's not about anti-Semitism. But what we did see was racism. We saw anti-Palestinian racism. We saw Islamophobia. We saw anti-Arab racism. And that is really what's most present in Congress that no one is talking about. And we saw it on full display. The other thing I'll just say is that, you know, in terms of the fight that's happening within the Democratic Party, broadly speaking, you know, the Thursday's vote was really hard, but in the bigger scale, the bigger picture, there is unprecedented support for Palestinian rights in Congress right now from the progressive wing of the party, broadly speaking. That is very much existing. And we only need to look to last summer to see that, right? Tens of thousands of people poured into the street day after day in May to demand that the U.S. step up and finally speak out for and defend Palestinian rights and stop funding Israel's violence against Palestinians. And I think that progressives in Congress, the progressive left in Congress, is finally representing what its base wants. It is increasingly popular. Poll after poll shows that Democratic voters want to see more accountability for the Israeli government. They want to see less of a blank check. They want to see a reduction. They want to see conditions put on the money that we send to the Israeli military. And progressives in Congress are finally listening to what their base wants and are standing up for that. And there is a backlash against it, right? So now there's a fight, there's a wedge growing within the Democratic Party where you've got progressives who are standing up for Palestinian rights. And then you've got the rest of the old guard of the Democratic Party that sees interest in trying to continue unconditional, unwavering support for the Israeli government, no matter what.
I think you're right. But it's also important to, like you pointed out, that none of the progressives really came to Rashida Tlaib's defense.
That's right.
During the debate, which is equally shocking and disappointing.
That's right. It's shocking and it's incredibly disappointing.
And to get into that a little bit more, a lot of attention has been paid to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's actions here. It appears she initially voted no, but then changed her vote to present. She was seen in a heated discussion with Nancy Pelosi on the House floor before changing her vote, and she was seen visibly upset and crying afterwards. She released a statement the next day, putting the blame on the leadership, meaning Pelosi and Majority Leader Hoyer, and claiming that the way the bill had been pushed forward was irresponsible and dangerous and had led to, quote, a tinderbox of vitriol, disingenuous framing, deeply racist accusations and depictions, and lack of substantive discussion on the matter, end quote. And that tracks with everything that you've shared with us today. The statement seems to have caused more confusion than clarity, though. What do you make of it? What do you make of her vote, given that she played a key role in trying to block the funding in the first place?
Mm-hmm. I'll start by saying that Representative Ocasio-Cortez should have voted no. It's very disappointing that she voted present. And she needs to hear from her base that she should have voted no and that that's what her base wanted. It was the wrong decision to do anything but a no vote on this bill. And honestly, I think that if we look through her statement, there was not a lot of clarity on the actual final decision about switching to a present. So we may never know exactly what the final decision was or where it came from. I think what her statement did do is clearly signal and indicate that she wanted to vote no. For whatever reason, again, that we don't understand, she did not vote no. And to explain why she wanted to vote no, right? Part of it explains why she was against this $1 billion funding to the Israeli government, the Israeli military, which tracks with her past actions in Congress, right? Her past actions in Congress have been incredibly supportive of Palestinian rights. She has co-sponsored all of the best legislation, right? Like Betty McCollum's Palestinian Children and Families Act. She was one of the first co-sponsors on that bill. She's voted against anti-BDS legislation. She led the most powerful anti-annexation letter last summer to push back and demand accountability and threaten conditions on funding if Israel moved forward with annexation. She led on an attempt last May to block a $735 million Boeing bomb sale to the Israeli government. And then when that didn't work, she recently, just a couple weeks ago, led an amendment to the NDAA to try to stop the transfer of those weapons. In May, we heard her give a floor speech amid the military assault on Gaza. So, you know, it tracks with her past record in Congress that she would have been against this vote and she should have voted no as a result. I don't want to get too deeply into speculating why she changed from no to present because we just can't actually know. I will say that I think that, you know, she voted present and the sad fact is that there were also a lot of other pro-Palestinian, traditionally pro-Palestinian voices in Congress who also voted yes. I think it does speak to what she indicated in her statement, which I want to be very clear that I'm not defending her present vote. I think that what she indicated in her statement was the vitriol of this moment and the nastiness of the inner machinations of Democratic leadership, which is probably also part of why so many other progressives made such a horrible, an unacceptable, honestly, yes vote on this bill too.
Yeah, I agree. I think Betty McCollum's yes vote is far problematic than AOC's present vote.
Incredibly problematic. And, you know, I will say there was also yes votes from Representative Mark Pocan and yep. Representative yep. Pramila Jayapal, Representative yep. Jamal Bowman, Barbara Lee. These are all people yep. who should have been, every one of them should have been a strong no vote. And it is they all need to be held accountable for the fact that they just voted in favor of, or in Representative Ocasio-Cortez's case, just voted present on $1 billion to fund an apartheid regime.
It's a longstanding tactic from the pro-Israel groups to make any debate over any of these issues nasty and ugly and, full of what AOC said in her statement, vitriol,
yes.
disingenuous framing. That's the playbook. That's exactly what it is. And any struggle to change these policies is going to have to fight its way through that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking that you can avoid that by strategically voting yes on something like this is, yes. I think, wrongheaded. It has to be fought and overcome inside Congress.
Yeah, I would strongly agree. I would just strongly agree with that.
And speaking about that, what were the Israel lobby groups like AIPAC doing on this bill to ramp up the vitriol, disingenuous framing, and deeply racist accusations?
Right. I would not recommend doing this, but if any of your listeners really want to, you can go to AIPAC's Twitter page.
Yes.
Or, you know, Democratic Majority for Israel's Twitter page and see what they were saying. I would, you know, save yourself the pain. Don't necessarily do it, but... honestly, the things that were being said can really only be described as lies, just straight up lies. That's what was going on. And the messaging coming out of these groups, these anti-Palestinian groups, was that, you know, they were trying to push forward this message that if you vote against this $1 billion, you do not care about Jewish life. That was the message. That was their top line. And on top of that, the second half of their top line was, if you don't vote for this $1 billion, then poor little Israeli government cannot fund the defensive missiles that they need to survive. And that's all of that. Every single part of that is factually untrue, right? On the one hand, like I said before, none of this has to do with protecting Jewish safety specifically. It's all about sending more unconditional military funding to a violent apartheid regime that is, you know, that is forcing Palestinians in Gaza to live under a brutal military blockade and then raining down other US-funded bombs on top of them and preventing them from fleeing, right? Like, this is the most brutal, obvious situation. but these groups were spinning this as though a vote against this $1 billion would somehow be a disregard for Israeli or Jewish life, one way or the other. And then the second half, of course, is this idea that if we don't send this $1 billion, Israel won't have what it needs. Like I've said before, we already are sending $500 million to fund the Iron Dome this year alone. And of course, there's the other incredibly obvious point that not nearly enough people were making, which is Israel could pay for it themselves, right? Just because Israel says they need something doesn't mean that the American taxpayer has to pay for it.
That's right.
That's two separate things. And I think that that is something that got deeply and intentionally ignored in Congress this week as well.
And we'll link to it in the show notes. Khalid El-Gindi wrote a piece after this bill was passed, looking at the part of that argument that the Iron Dome saves Israeli and Palestinian lives. And he made some very good points about it may actually do the opposite, because it allows Israel space to continue conflict because it's got this shield. And and it lowers the cost to them. Again, I'm not advocating for people to be killed in any kind of military conflict, but these arguments are disingenuous.
Mm-hmm. Right. It goes back to this idea of, you know, at the end of the day, if you are sending weapons and military funding to the aggressor, even if they are, quote unquote, purely defensive weapons, should you actually be sending them to the aggressor in the situation, right?
That's right.
That's the question kind of put to us. And I will just add one other thing on this, which is another argument that was kind of being put forward by some advocates of this $1 billion funding. And we saw this come from kind of certain spaces in particular, was this, what was essentially a threat, right? We saw the argument get made that the Iron Dome also saves Palestinian lives in Gaza because it makes it less likely that the Israeli government will do a ground invasion of Gaza. And when they do a ground invasion, more Palestinians die, which is one of the most disgusting arguments I think I've ever seen be made, right? That is, that is a straight up threat of violence. That is blackmail. That was these people saying, Congress, you need to give us what we want or else we will kill more Palestinians.
That's right. And El-Gindi talks about that in his piece, and he points out that it's not true that there have been ground invasions since the Iron Dome system was rolled out.
Absolutely. That is
so again, it's just not true. And
it's just
where are Palestinians Iron Dome to protect them from the air attacks that Israel carries out on a pretty regular basis? So Beth, what comes next? It feels like this fight isn't over, and the division within the Democratic Party over Israel is deeper than it's ever been. There's also a bill in the House that would lock in U.S. commitment to a two-state solution. What should people be watching and gearing up for?
This fight is absolutely not over. The Palestinian rights movement and the folks who are doing congressional advocacy within the Palestinian rights movement are consistently and have been for years and will continue to increasingly push for rights-based legislation that demands greater accountability for where our money is going, for how it is used, and to reduce, cut, and eventually, hopefully, end the flow of U.S. dollars that funds Israel's violent apartheid government. So there's a few different examples of what this looks like, right? Like we've seen, for example, this year, Representative Betty McCollum introduced H.R. 2590, the Palestinian Children and Families Act, which would ensure that not a single dollar of U.S. funding to the Israeli government can be used for the arrest, detention, ill treatment, torture of Palestinian children by the Israeli military. This is something that happens on a regular basis in the West Bank specifically. The Israeli military can arrest and does arrest around 700 children a year and puts them through a court system, a military court system, where they have no rights granted to them, no due process rights whatsoever, and where 3 out of 4 of them are subject to physical violence. So first of all, it would ensure that not a dollar of our money can go toward that. It would also ensure that our money can't go to pay for the demolition of Palestinian homes or the forced displacement of Palestinian families from their homes. And anyone who is paying attention over the summer has probably seen an increased awareness in the media, this in particular, right? Like in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, in Jerusalem. But this has been happening across Palestine for as long as Israel has existed, right? The demolition of homes, the forced displacement of families. So it would also ensure that our money can't go toward that. And then finally, it would ensure that our money cannot pay for or fund any part of Israeli annexation, in other words, theft of Palestinian land. So that bill is an example of the starting point in Congress, right? That is the bare minimum of what we should be getting from Congress, is an assurance that the money we are already sending isn't being used for these horrific human rights violations against Palestinians. But I think what comes next is that we should be pushing for, and we will be pushing for, actual stronger and harsher conditions and withholding of our funding, right? That's where the power and the accountability really comes in. Is Israel, the Israeli government needs to know that if they continue these human rights violations, if they continue apartheid, they will not get our funding. That's where the leverage comes in. And anything less than that ultimately will not actually change the situation on the ground. And that is what we have all been building toward. And that is what we need from progressives in Congress, is to step up and be ready to say, listen, this funding is conditional. And if you are violating Palestinian human rights in Gaza, inside of Israel proper, in 48, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in any of these areas, any part of Palestine, then you will not get our funding, right? We won't pay for it. We won't pay for these human rights violations. And so that's I think, what needs to come next, right? That's what we should be pushing for. You mentioned the recently introduced Two-State Solution Act, which Representative Andy Levin co-sponsored, and it was introduced on Thursday, actually right before the Iron Dome bill. That bill is ultimately an example of a bill that is rooted in the flawed framing that so many Democrats come to this issue from, right? Where they act as though the only possible way forward and the most important thing is a two-state solution. And, you know, putting aside the question of the two-state solution, right? Like even like, which is a huge, even putting that aside, right?
Right.
Why is that the focus of Democrats in Congress? Shouldn't their focus be that our funding isn't being used for human rights violations, and let the people who are directly impacted by these things be the ones to decide what comes next and what the way forward is? The job of Congress is to control the purse strings of our budget, not to dictate what the state solution looks like. Their job is to control our budget and to make sure that our dollars are not being used toward apartheid, towards human rights violations, toward military assaults on Palestinians living in the world's largest open air prison, right? That's what they should be focused on. This is a mistake to orient so deeply towards solidifying US government support solely for a two-state solution. It misses the point. It should be centered on people first, right? There are good things in this bill. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that, right? Like there are parts of this bill that are important, right? End use restrictions to do things like ensure that our money isn't being used towards settlement growth, home demolitions, and things like that. There are good parts of this bill, but the broader framing of this bill is critically flawed. The other piece of this bill that is deeply concerning, perhaps even more concerning, is that there is part of this bill that reaffirms the commitment to the full memorandum of understanding, right? To fully funding that $3.8 billion we send every year. And that undercuts all of this, right? It undercuts the push for broader accountability. If we're saying, no matter what, we're not going to ever condition this funding in any real way, why would the Israeli government actually change its path? Why would it actually change its behavior? So that's some of the problems and issues that are really deeply at hand with that bill in particular. But I think that in terms of what Palestinian advocates and the Palestinian rights movement will be pushing for, it's not a secret. It's what I said before. It's that we need real conditions and we need withholding and we need to reduce and eventually stop this flow of money toward the Israeli military.
I will note that Democratic Majority for Israel has already come out mm-hmm. in opposition to the two-state bill. It's claiming that it rewrites ancient history.
Yes. You know, that's true. And I think that, you know, I'm sure that Representative Levin and the co-sponsor of this bill will get pushback from the right. That is absolutely going to happen. And I think it speaks to how distorted this entire conversation has become, right? That anything less than complete and total unwavering support for the Israeli government is considered bad, right? And let's be clear, this bill is not that. This bill is critical of the Israeli government. It places blame on the Israeli government for settlement expansion, for the occupation, et cetera. And so for a group like Democratic Majority for Israel, which has never met a dollar to the Israeli military that it didn't support, this bill is they think it's flawed. But, you know, as we all know, as activists, just because you have people mad on you on both sides doesn't mean you're doing the right thing.
So, Beth, what can folks do to support the work that you and JVP Action are doing?
Great question. So, you know, I think that the first thing and probably the most urgent and important thing is that your member of Congress should hear from you right now, no matter who they are, right? So the Democrats who voted no on this bill, for example, were Representative Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, Ayanna Pressley, Marie Newman, Chuy Garcia, Raul Grijalva, and Andre Carson. If you are their constituent, stop what you are doing, pick up the phone, call their office, and say thank you. They need to know that they have support for this vote. If you have a member of Congress who voted present, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Hank Johnson, pick up the phone, call their office, and say that it's good they didn't vote yes, but present is unacceptable, and they needed to have voted no, and that this was a mistake, and that they just voted present on a bill to send $1 billion to an apartheid military. And then if you have a representative, which most of you do, who voted yes, you pick up the phone and you can just rage. They should hear from you and they should know that you as their constituent are furious that they voted yes for this funding. And they need that pushback. And I will say that I imagine there are people who are feeling very, very much like, probably right now there are people who are feeling like it's not worth engaging Congress anymore, right? Like, look at what just happened. And I understand that instinct. But I know for a fact that when they get flooded with calls, it matters. They all got flooded with calls before this Iron Dome vote, and that impacted a lot of their decisions. And so they need to know when you are glad that they did something good, and they need to know when you are angry that they did something bad. It really does, it does influence them, and it does make a difference. So that is the most urgent, important thing you can do. If you visit the JVP Action website, that's jvpaction.org, you can sign up to stay involved in our work. We are constantly sending out action alerts and keeping people in the loop on ways that they can take both long-term organizing action as well as immediate steps on urgent issues like this one. And so that's another way that you can make sure that you're staying in the loop, and you can do things like get engaged to support Betty McCollum's bill, which I mentioned before, for example, and be ready to know what's coming next and what's coming down the pipeline.
Beth Miller, JVP Action, thank you so much. This was a wonderful, enlightening, educational discussion. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And thanks for being on the Mondo Wise podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Dave. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWise.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics.
Yeah.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
That is the most urgent, important thing you can do. If you visit the JVP Action website, that's jvpaction.org, you can sign up to stay involved in our work. We are constantly sending out action alerts and keeping people in the loop on ways that they can take both long-term or...
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This is a poem called The White Judges. We lived in an old schoolhouse, one large room that my father converted into two stories with a plank staircase leading to the second floor. A single window on the south wall created a space that was dimly lit, even at midday. All nine kids and the occasional friend slept upstairs like cadets in rows of shared double beds, ate downstairs in the kitchen near the gas stove, and watched TV near the airtight heater in the adjacent room. Our floors were worn linoleum and scatter rugs, our walls high and bare except for the family photos, whose frames were crowded with siblings waiting to come of age, marry, or leave. At supper, 11 of us would stare down a pot of moose stew, bannock, and tea, while outside, the white judges sat encircling our house. And they waited to judge, waited till we ate tripe, watched us inhale its wild vapor, sliced and steaming on our plates. Watched us welcome it into our being, sink our teeth into its rubbery texture, chew and roll each